Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, we are joined once again by Robert Penner. The Dark King Swallows the World, the new novel. Welcome back, Robert.
Thanks. Good to be back.
So, a vastly different book than Strange Labor.
It certainly is.
And so, I'm always curious, like, where a book comes from, but for wildly varying books, especially, idea to idea, what birthed this?
Well, it's actually, its origins are much older than Strange Labor. So my daughter was born about 15 years ago, and I had the late shift, like from 4 a.m. till dawn.
Right.
And she'd fall asleep, and I'd be bored out of my skull. And so I started writing the first few chapters there. And part of it was just, you got to do something. So you're holding a kid in one arm. And if you move, she wakes up. And you're typing with the other. And it also turned out to be sort of a good story for working through new parent anxieties about mortality and control and the limits of love and all of that business.
Sure enough. So did you start at the beginning of this story?
Yeah, I started at the beginning, word one, and then just started writing. And so most of it probably got written in order. And then in the editing process, you go back and you play around and rearrange.
Right.
But really, it was like an A to Z kind of a novel.
So your central character in this, Nora, is 12.
Yeah.
And so I'm always curious about kind of the age at which a character, particularly like a younger character, is, and how important that is to kind of like what they know about the world, how they see the world, how things are processed.
Right.
And so 12 is, preteen, like a tween.
Yeah.
And so knowledgeable, but there's a lot maybe still to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And how important, like, was Nora 12 from the beginning?
When I started writing, probably pretty ambiguous in terms of her age. There's just sort of a classic coming of age, fantasy age that you've already talked about. And so I knew she was in there somewhere. I was also not even remotely interested in the social realistic kind of aspect of it. So she is pretty precocious. She knows quite a lot about the universe, but there's huge gaps. And then when I went back to the book, when my daughter was in her teens, early teens, she wasn't in her teens yet, but early teens, exactly at that age, she was there all the time talking to me. So there's occasionally words and sentences that I just stole from my daughter, or at least sort of emotional formulations that were sort of, that I thought probably typical, that I borrowed from her and used in the characterization. But initially I didn't give it too much thought. And the younger brother too, again, it was like a fairly impressionistic sense of their age. And then it sort of got formulated as I progressed.
So obviously, like, you are able to kind of pull some idiom or like behavioral things or verbal tics from your daughter, but you're writing it initially, your daughter's an infant.
Yeah.
So you're maybe wrestling with things in the future, like future casting, but you're also setting it in the past.
Uh-huh.
The decision to set this when you do, during like the war years when, London is evacuated.
Uh-huh.
How important was that to the telling? Because this is a kid who exists in kind of a liminal space within their own family, but then also within kind of their own life, right? Like they've been kind of kicked out of the town they know by the war.
Right. So there's a third level to it, and that's in a lot of ways, this book is a conversation with classic sort of, I would say, English coming-of-age fantasy.
Okay.
And so the influence of C.S. Lewis and the Narnia series is all over it. And that series, too, begins with kids fleeing the Blitz into the countryside. And when I began writing it, I don't think I was consciously thinking of that, but it was certainly there in the unconscious background that for me, I was read those stories as a child. They're deeply embedded in my psyche. And I suspect that at four in the morning, when you're beginning to spin a tale like this, that might've been a factor. And the other thing about the periodization is I liked it because the reader knows so much more about it than the participants. So you really, it's a pleasant way to explore what Nora knows and what she doesn't, because it's just simply a very sort of historicized period. Like everybody has opinions and thoughts and knowledge about that. So there's no explanation necessary. You can write a whole book about World War II and not mention, say, Hitler. And everyone knows in the background somewhere there's that, right? So it allows a certain sort of depth of background that's very luxurious for a writer, that there's a lot of things you just don't have to explain.
I suppose having the reader have some knowledge while the character has to suss things out flavors things differently. Like people come to it with some either like expectations or baggage that then they either have to like put down or set aside as the character kind of leads them somewhere new.
And that's up to the reader. I mean, whether you resist or whether you don't. But it's like you say, it's totally different than building an entirely secondary world where it's the character leading the reader through it in a very different way than when you're watching this and you're 70, 80 years into the future looking back. It's a very different vibe. So in Strange Labor, one of the purposes of the character is to guide the reader through this world. And in this book, that's simply not the case.
We talked about kind of like the world building
in
Strange Labor. And you don't have to do that lifting in a book like this when you're setting it in, like, as you said, a period that's been in novels, it's been in movies. People kind of have, like, they can kind of almost, you show the character, and then if it's like green screen, like we all kind of project the, like, the manor behind her.
Or, like, you feel, and people can just fill in the stage themselves in a lot of sense. And it's also not science fictional, right? It's fantasy. So you're also less tied to explanation in that sense as well. So it's much more purely, I guess, maybe psychological, in that you're exploring the interiority a lot more than you would be in a different sort of text.
Right. So speaking of fantasy and like kind of playing with things, there's a passage where Nora's talking to Mr. Lowry, talking about historicity and myth.
Uh-huh.
And they break down stories. And I'm always curious about when like an author puts, you know, writing about storycraft into a book. It's like very metatextual, and I find it fascinating to kind of see, like, are you wrestling with something here? And so Nora kind of like battles with Mr. Lowry about, like, you know, how much truth is in this? And Mr. Lowry's like, well, does that matter? And then they have a debate about, like, you know, well, I've always found that the stories begin the same way and it's the exciting stuff at the end. How much of that are you like conscious of as you're writing it?
That particular example to me is particularly interesting because it's about the saints, right? And so the stories he's telling are actually sort of hagiographies of Cornish saints.
Yeah.
And my background's in history. So one of the things I'm very interested in is how you extract sort of objective material from clearly hagiographical texts. So I wasn't deliberately saying, okay, now I'm going to talk to the reader about these issues, about the relationship of myth and sort of historical fact, but it's always on my mind. And I thought at the time I was also thinking about Nora as this like assertively atheistic and empirical juvenile, and Lowry as this guy who's got 60, 70 years of faith and belief behind him, and what that conversation would look like if it wasn't in any way condescending or they weren't being ironic with each other, but it was just this debate between two completely different creatures about how to understand a text. And I wasn't trying to be like pedagogical. It was just, that was what I was thinking about at the time. I was actually also in the middle of writing a dissertation. And so it makes its way into the text and then it's there. And you're like, okay, this is interesting. And not only that, it's allowing me to think about these characters in ways I hadn't been thinking about them before. And then I think from that point on, there was constantly this theme about what's real and what isn't. You evaluate it. And of course, that's just in a fantasy universe that in and of itself is an interesting subtext.
Right, because then it leads later on to talk about dreams and whether, you know, what they're experiencing is a dream or not. And then I think Nora is the one who says, like, does that even really matter?
Right.
And so, like, we do as a reader kind of follow Nora's journey. And at some point it's like, is she really experiencing this? Is a question that becomes recurrent.
Yeah, it is. And it's when you're writing these fantasies, you're always kind of aware in the background of, what's the move? Is this like real, right? Like, or is it like a psychotic experience, or is it a dreamscape? Is it going to be one of those stories where they wake up at the end and it was all a dream, you know? And so I think I enjoy that kind of play in genre. Like I enjoy that you don't necessarily know which direction a writer is going, and it doesn't matter to me which direction a writer is going, but it was pleasant to write it without having a sense of what it was going to be. And at the same time to have the characters sort of having a conversation with you as the writer about, well, how are you actually going to get out of this?
Right. You're kind of posing the question, like, do I lead the reader along in believing something? Like do I make them take it on faith? Right. Or do I present legitimate signposts that allow them to become believers? Like,
and so I declined to answer, right? Like in the text itself, I think it was a similar game in Strange Labor as well, this refusal. And I don't know why or what I'm trying to prove or if I'm trying to prove anything, but it's just pleasant to me to raise the question and not answer it. And at the same time, have all this play occurring with the characters themselves trying to understand this phenomenon. And I suppose that's just more than anything else, just a reflection of my own sort of experience of life, right? Of just never quite being sure what's happening to me.
And I suppose if you're writing this in like 4 a.m. till dawn, right? Like that is a peak, like what's going on in my head time.
Right, with like, a first child, it really is it's a perpetual what the hell is going on kind of experience. You're always exhausted. You're always struck with these new responsibilities, right? And these new anxieties that you've never experienced before. And so you really are in a perpetual state of uncertainty and confusion. And I think that's a good space to begin writing a fantasy novel.
Yeah. Now, when we talk about Strange Labor, the journey that the territory that was covered was based on, you know, your own driving.
Uh-huh.
Cornwall.
Uh-huh.
Setting this book in Cornwall, what led you there? In the
dissertation.
Story?
I was doing my PhD in history at Duke University, and it was a good chunk of it was about 19th century Cornwall and the emergence of a certain type of Methodism in that space. So it was raw material that was just there at my hands. And one of the things that struck me the first time I was in Cornwall, and I'm certainly not the first to be struck by this, but it has a reputation sort of in the arts as sort of this Arthurian, like distant pre-medieval, medieval kind of a space. And when you go there, the landscape is just relentlessly post-industrial, right? There's the remains of mining everywhere. There's viaducts. You're just never not, if you're paying attention, you're never not aware of the immediate industrial past. And so one of the things I was very interested in was, all right, my vision as it was formulated through reading sort of young adult books about Cornwall and the fantastic was one thing, and then I go there and it's another thing entirely, and how can I write a fantasy? And again, we're talking about, I guess, empiricism and reality that incorporates this reality of Cornwall into a fantastic world rather than the old traditional, you know, sword in the stone, mists and castle ruins kind of a fantasy.
Yeah, something like the Green Knight or something.
Right, exactly.
This, because I was going to ask you about, like, we talked about, like, not having necessarily world building when it comes to, like, talking about, you know, like, World War II England, but there is some world building in terms of this Dark King's realm,
mm-hmm.
but you're obviously drawing from, like, an industrial landscape or post-industrial landscape that essentially this netherworld already exists.
Yeah, and as Nora's entering quite slowly this fantastic realm and exploring the landscape on her own, just making sure those things are there and also paying attention to how she interprets this thing. So we've talked about Lowry already. She's frustrated because she goes to Lowry and she wants to know what this stone she found is, this ruin, and she's hoping it's like druids and human sacrifice. And he's like, no, that's part of a foundry or what have you. And so on the one hand, she is frustrated with him for his fantasies about the Cornish religious past. And then at the same time, she gets frustrated with him for his empiricism about the recent past. And that whole tension between the more ancient Cornish past and the contemporary one is something that like runs through sort of Cornish political culture as well, which is the real Cornwall kind of a thing.
Yeah, I was very curious because like when she starts to kind of like embark on her actual journey,
mm-hmm.
rather than kind of her wanderings, let's say, that it seems like this netherworld, but it could be a plausible real thing that she's like imbuing with dark overtones, right?
Like
that it's that younger person who doesn't fully understand things drawing their own conclusions off of something that maybe isn't as
mm-hmm.
nefarious as they make it out to be.
Maybe not. I mean, and I would also think like this idea of her, what she's drawing on to create the vision she's experiencing. The other thing about industrial Cornwall is that I was really trying to get at in the netherworld as well as the real world is that it's fed by the forces of global capitalism, right? Like this industry is a global industry and Cornwall extends out into the Atlantic. So when you're in England and you go to Cornwall, it seems like you're traveling back and past the past because you're leaving London. You go on this long train ride and like Penzance is as far away as Edinburgh, right? So there's this feeling you're just going back. But in another sense, you're going closer and closer to sort of the center of sort of Atlantic history and industrialization and global capitalism. And so one of the things that Nora experiences in the netherworld is all of these sort of these forces in her own language that she understands sort of coming home to roost.
Yeah, I guess nefarious wasn't the best choice because like capitalism can certainly be nefarious, but mm-hmm. You know, maybe like satanic, for lack of a better term. You mentioned Rabelais mm-hmm. in the book and kind of like in an offhand manner. And I'm very curious about kind of when a real writer crops up in another writer's work. Like, had you been reading Rabelais at the time, or like why?
At the time when I did the name drop, I had been, but that's already like 15 years ago. So I can't say precisely what I was thinking the minute I dropped it. But certainly one of the things I was thinking about was Rabelais as an example of sort of an early modern writer. That yes, he's in the ancient past. In some ways, certainly to a girl of Nora's age, it would seem like long, long, long ago. Mm-hmm. But to the character who's mentioning it to her, it's something that's actually quite recent and that belongs to the same universe as us. So the universe of Rabelais with Gargantua and giants and all of that and his idiom, in some ways, that's also ours, our modern world. It's a long time ago, but sort of the horizons of our experience, I think, are quite similar in some ways to the horizons of Rabelais.
Yeah, because you're populating your world with like poets and artists and people who have read Rabelais,
right?
But are maybe dismissive of certain artists or poets.
Uh-huh.
And so creating a world in which like these people are intelligent but maybe opinionated, and then uh-huh. sharing those opinions with a young girl who's formulating her own opinions or trying to learn things. I was curious, like as you said, it's been 15 years since you know the name drop for Rabelais came in. Whether there was something you were trying to like.
I think this scene also, like not Rabelais per se, but what you're saying about all these artists is I'm very interested in artistic scenes and the intensity of debates within those scenes. So the initial impetus for the story idea, even before I started writing, I was in Cornwall and there was a display. There's a Tate in St. Ives in Western Cornwall, and they had a display, a show on called The Dark Monarch. And it was fantastic. And it was all about artists in Cornwall sort of interfacing with the idea of magic. And central to it was a book by a guy called Sven Berlin, who was part of the art scene in Cornwall in World War II. And he wrote this book called The Dark Monarch that I've never been able to get my hands on, but I've seen one fragment from. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, the book was like, well, I want to read that book and I can't read it, so I'm going to write it. And Sven Berlin was part of one of these scenes of sort of very avant-garde-ish, sort of squabbling, fighting writers. And the reason it never got published is because he got sued and there were too many people in the book who didn't want it published because it was biographical.
Oh.
And so it wasn't a book like mine at all, but there was this one fragment of text. But that idea of scenes and squabbling and artists fighting about how do we understand this world, how do we represent it, is something I've always been interested in.
It's another thing you explore through her tutor.
Yeah.
Particularly in terms of how we understand the colonial world.
Right.
And so how important was building in that tutor who had a lot to kind of like question about the supremacy of English Orthodox?
He was a later arrival in terms of the writing. So the second stage of writing, when I picked it up and said, I want to finish this, that's when he's arriving. And one of the reasons he's there is because I started reading it and it was like, oh my God, it's just another white fantasy. So on the one hand, I'm gesturing at colonialism, but it's still this very, very white thing. And so I wanted a character who was both deeply embedded in the artistic scene, but looking at it from a colonial or a post-colonial perspective, and providing Nora with the means to critique, I suppose, her own whiteness, her own position in a colonial world. And so that's where that came from. And then also just interested in sort of South Asian colonial resistance and post-colonialism and sort of the incredible sort of sophisticated theoretical fluency of those movements. I thought it would be fun to have a character like that who understood at least as well as everyone else everything that was going on around him in these scenes, but could articulate in very sophisticated, to me, ways a critique.
And he gives you kind of a sparring partner for Nora.
Yeah.
Which I find is often, I mean, we talked about this in Strange Labor, that like, you know, you needed that second character to kind of like clash of contrasts or like differing worldviews. to kind of like suss out.
Yeah, and he's aggressive, right? Like, he doesn't take prisoners. Whereas a lot of the other characters she does talk to are quite kind to her and quite gentle, whereas her tutor suffers no fools. And so it really allows her to, I think, unwind and be more assertive and aggressive in her own way and start pushing and pushing and pushing in ways gentler figures, and there's plenty of them who engage her, don't.
Yeah, she, like, I think he even says, like, if I wasn't paid, I wouldn't be here kind of thing.
Yeah, like, right. Like, and that's always one of the issues, too, with precocious children in textbooks is they can, in some ways, they're very annoying, right? Because they're wanting both to be a child and to engage as an adult. So it's, I thought it was kind of a refreshing moment to write a character saying, you know what, you're precocious, but I don't care. I'm only here because your mother doesn't want to deal with educating you.
Well, speaking of her mother, so when you conceive of the initial character of Nora, like, and you start to kind of build out her family and, like, who she is based on who she's from.
Right.
And what she's experienced. How did you arrive at kind of like her mother's story?
Well, I suppose just watching. I mean, just in life, there's an idea of what mothers are supposed to be, and there's an idea of what they're not. And certainly from the perspective of sort of, you know, I mean, middle-class morality, her mother isn't a good mother. I quite like her. I happen to think she is a good mother, but she's behaving in a way that's not considered in general appropriate to motherhood. So, and I think that's the parenting thing that was really, like, I was trying to get my head around, what does it mean? What are my obligations? What's my relationship to this mewling child, right? Like, what am I? And there's a tension, right, to being a parent that you don't necessarily experience until you are one, that it's you know, you lose a lot, right? You lose a lot of freedom, depending on how you imagine your role. And one of the things Nora's mother is struggling with in the book is not a lack of love for her children, but she's also got all these other pressures impinging on her and her psyche and herself that she has to cope with. And you have to navigate both your responsibility towards your child and towards yourself. And so I think at that moment, it was useful to have a character like her who was so idiosyncratic to start sort of exploring all these ideas about obligation and what are the limits of obligation and love.
Well, speaking of like obligation, Nora's ostensible journey is for her brother.
Right.
But it ends up being more for her mother.
Yeah.
And like, was that an intentional choice that, like, she saves her mother rather than anything else?
It was pretty organic. It wasn't what I was thinking right at the beginning, but I would say by a third of the way through, I knew that's where it was going to end. That, I mean, death is death, and you can't solve it. But there is this chance, like, that at least from Nora's perspective, there was this chance to sort of salvage her relationship with her mother, or at least refashion it in a way that was more suited to what she wanted. And I would say about a third of the way through, I was like, okay, this is the basic tension. She's going to want to try and do this for her mother ultimately, no matter what she tells herself, and that at least in some sense, she'll fall short.
Nora starts separated from her mother.
Yeah.
And then there's physical separation, and then there's like emotional separation, and then there's like this spiritual separation.
Right.
And like a veil kind of comes down across her mother. The varying stages of separation and which type they were, was that something like it just came about organically as well? Or were you thinking about kind of like, you know, presence in a child's life in a, like a material or physical sense versus like emotional investment, like these kinds
of things?
Well,
when you say it, I mean, it sounds like it was always there, and it must have been, but I have to admit, I hadn't really articulated it like that. But that staged separation is definitely built into the plot. And now that I'm thinking about it, I couldn't even tell you exactly how or why, but certainly the sense of, and again, when you're first trying to deal with a child, of this intense love you have for them, but also this awareness of like an incredible gulf that lies between you and their experience. And so what you're describing in this staged separation between the two, I think, is sort of a manifestation of this awareness that there's always going to be this gulf that can't be like surpassed between these two subjective experiences of the child and the parent, and that it is going to often be, as you say, sort of sequential, like eventually, like there's the physical separation of the child leaving the mother's body, and then this, for Nora, the separation in space and time, and then it never, the breach never gets quite healed, no matter how much both of them want it to get healed. And I think framing it like that, as physical and then emotional and then spiritual, is a very helpful way of thinking about the book.
Well, it's also interesting because like Nora being 12, like teenage years are kind of when like the I becomes central, right? And that's when like that like defining yourself in opposite to someone else, right?
Right.
So it's usually to your parents or to your family, right? That like, no, I'm my own person. Mm-hmm. That like the Nora's at that point.
Yeah. And it's complicated for her because that's the whole of her family is this one person.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't have the luxury of falling back on other relationships. So there's these other adults in the book that do provide her with a sense of comfort and a sense of space and a sense of support. But she's still ultimately in this one-on-one relationship with her mother that neither of them can escape and will always be there. And she still has, but she still has to define herself in some way as distinct from this person who's been her whole world.
And she's been cut off from the world she knew, right? Like as someone who's been moved because of the Blitz, like there's the physical like relocation that.
And a lot of the anger in the character too towards her mother has to do with forced separations as well, where her mother claims the separation is for one reason and Nora, you know, feels it's for another, right? Like a CD assignation, right?
Right.
And so that a lot, I would say most of the anger in Nora's character comes from this sense of being sort of excluded from parts of her mother's life. And I think that's also an explanation for her incredible precociousness, that she's being forced by the situation to deal with adult situations and have adult conversations, because that's only the only way can she remain a part of her mother's world.
Right, that her mother won't kind of like come down to her level. She has to seek her mother out in the like literal and figurative senses.
Yeah.
The title.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the obvious title or did you wrestle with it?
This book was hard to name. My publisher suggested the title. My working title was Dark Monarch because of that book, but I didn't want to use it because it's just a completely different kind of a project. And then there was a whole host of titles I was working with for a long time. There's a song by Ron Sexsmith called Secret Heart, and that was the title for a long period of time. There were a couple of others, a couple of them that just horrified for their clumsiness some of the readers. The line itself is from fairly late in the book, and my publisher picked it out, and she said, "This is what I think it should be," and I think it does exactly the right kind of work. I mean, a lot of my titles tended to be more philosophical and pretentious, and I think what this title does is it captures all the ideas, but it also links it very specifically to kind of like a genre ethos, like a fantasy ethos. And I think I sometimes struggle to, I drift too frequently towards the literary in a text like this. And particularly in this one, I was very comfortable with it being drawn back to like, this is a fantasy in the end. This is a fantasy story. It's not something else.
It's a very ominous title.
Yeah,
so.
And it is dark as well.
It definitely invites.
So, I mean, it's coming out at around Halloween, so that's like moderately convenient.
Well, there you go. The Dark King Swallows the World. Robert Penner, thanks very much for coming in and talking about it.
Oh, my pleasure, as always.